My mission, to end the silence, the stigma, and the shame about suicide. Please join me. In this episode, we're going to discuss the complex themes of grief, the struggles with mental illness within families, and the transformative power of empathy. This is what I discuss with my guest, Stacy Short, who shares the tragic story of her brother Nathan. He battled bipolar disorder and addiction, ultimately leading to his suicide. Be sure and join us as she explores the consequences of his death on her family, the legal battles that ensued, and how it impacted their lives.
Suicide Zen Forgiveness, the pod that shares the stories of those affected by suicide. Lost a loved one? Attempted it yourself? Come listen in with your host, Elaine Lindsay. Please note, the Suicide Zen Forgiveness podcast is for education only. Some of this subject matter could be triggering. For those of you that are either grieving or having mental health problems, please call your local suicide hotline or mental health office if you need immediate help. And now, here's your host, Elaine Lindsay.
So I want to thank you so much, Stacy Short, joining us here today. I have to say I owe a great debt of thanks, because Stacy and I were having a chat when my father, who most of the audience may know, my father has dementia, and he had a bit of a moment thinking that my mom was still alive. And God bless Stacy, who took it in stride and just allowed me to move through it with my dad and not totally lose my mind. So thank you ever so much. Not the usual start to one of our episodes, but that will maybe give you an idea of how incredibly empathetic I find Stacy and how thrilled I am to be able to present her to you today. So, like usual, we converse here, and sometimes our stories just aren't linear. I always allow my guests to start where they want to, and we'll go where we need to go.
Sure. First of all, thank you for your time, your energy, and your platform, Elaine. I appreciate you, and thank you for allowing me the honor to hold space for you. I've always been empathetic. But I think because of my brother's death, it now looks a little bit different in that empathy. And what I realized through his suicide is that nobody could fix me. There was nothing anybody could do anything to make the process shorter, less difficult, whatever that was. And the best way that people treated me that was so effective for me was just their presence. Nothing else, just their presence and allowing me the space to process. And so I think that's something that has changed within me as far as the empathy and holding space that has happened after Nathan's death, is that has pivoted and grown stronger in that way. And I don't know that I would have ever gotten there without that.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really important point, because part of the reason that I do this podcast is for the fact that we don't, as a society, know what to do or what to say or what not to say. And it can be really difficult because people want to be helpful, most people, and sure, think that they are being helpful. But I just was interacting with a post yesterday where these people lost their child, and someone said, "How much longer are you going to grieve?"
Oh my God.
And
oh my
God.
How very dare you?
Yeah.
How very dare you?
Exactly. Oof. You know, you lost your baby brother, and I've lost my sister now, not in the same way. But when we lose people, our grief doesn't go away. It's not, oh, we're grieving till March the 5th at 10 a.m. and then it's done. No.
5 years in, gonna hang it up.
Yeah. Grief is like the tide. It comes in and it goes out and it changes. Sometimes there are angry seas and sometimes it's calm, but it's always there.
It's always there. It is always there. I don't want to say eating at me because I'm past that, but it's like a sore muscle.
Yes.
It's just, if you work out or walk or whatever, and you've had a sore muscle from gardening or whatever, and like you forget it's sore and then you move away, that aggravates it. And then you're like, oh, okay. That's what it's like now. It's just this dull ache that can absolutely flare into bowling me over if I allow it. Or if I, when I say I allow it, please understand that I'm not saying I have control over it always. But no. What I've learned through this process is if I try to push it down because it's an inconvenient time for me to be experiencing the grief, it comes back 10 times stronger.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this means if I hear one of our songs on the radio and I'm in the car and I get hit, some days I can hear it and be okay. Some days I'm singing at the top of my lungs in honor of him. I don't know what kind of day it's going to be until I hear it, though, until it happens. And so when it does hit, if it is one of those breakdown in tears, I've learned, okay, I'm just going to pull over on the side of the road until I'm done.
Yeah.
And before I was like, oh no, this is inconvenient. I can't do this right now. You need to go away. And then a few days later, it would literally take me out for a full day.
Yeah. I was just going to say, don't you find the more we push it down, the more prominent it becomes and the more it takes over. And yeah, the time frames can be much longer and can result in actual physical sickness as well.
Oh, 1000%. I already had fibromyalgia, so that just absolutely made it worse. And so when I would push it down, then I would have a fibro flare, because that's pretty much what fibromyalgia is. It's suppressed emotions, incomplete emotional cycles. And so I had so many of those in my life that this kind of was like the cherry on top in the worst kind of way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So not to go into specifics, but tell us a little bit about Nathan and what led to your family losing him.
My brother was a very bright child, just very bright, very precocious. Yeah, he was amazing. And then he started struggling at like 3 with regulation and anger control and all kinds of crazy stuff. He completely ripped up, scissored one of my bedspread because he was mad at me at something. Just very young. He chased us around with a knife. He absolutely destroyed the middle brother's door with a sword. Just all of this emotional dysregulation. And we didn't know how to help him because we didn't know what was going on. And he's 3, 4, 5. He doesn't have the language to say this, I'm feeling unsafe in some way, shape, or form. And so that's where it started. And it just grew from there. He eventually was diagnosed ADHD and tried a whole bunch of medication and then, I can't even remember, somewhere around 18, he was diagnosed manic depressive, bipolar. And so again, the search for the right medication, the right dosage, and he went through, I don't know, 8 medications then too. In different kind of varying forms. So instead, he got into self-medicating, which is what a lot of bipolar people do. And so he started using drugs. And then because of his mania, he would go out on motorcycles. He had a motorcycle and he would just really ride it in a stupid fashion. And he had 4 motorcycle wrecks that absolutely obliterated one of his knees. And so he went to the doctor, just like any of us would. And this was in the mid 2000s when the opiate crisis was like at its peak. And so he was prescribed opioids. And after about 4 years of being on opioids, the doctor said, you need surgery. And for those international people that are listening to this, our healthcare is tied to our career. It's tied to a job. It is not universal. It's not given to us. It is not a right. It is tied to your ability to be employed. And for him, because he was bipolar, being employed for any certain length and time was very difficult because he would hit a depressive episode and not be able to get out of bed, to call in, to do anything. He would just give up the job instead. And so employment for him was sketchy at best. But because of the state my parents lived in, they only saw him as an able-bodied, white, middle-class male. And there's no reason that he should not be able to be employed at some level. So he couldn't get like state help as far as the medical things that are out there, Medicaid, because they thought he should be able to hold a job. Wasn't true for him. And so after 4 years of being on opioid, the doctor said, that's enough. You need surgery. And he said, I don't know how I'm going to get surgery. It's not like my parents could pay $250,000 for a knee replacement out of pocket. And they said, that's it. No more meds.
Oh my
And they
God.
Cut him off cold turkey. He was on OxyContin. And if anybody's ever had an experience with OxyContin, I was on it for 3 weeks at one point in time at a really high pain level in my life after his death. And I had suicidal ideation. And I've never had suicidal ideation. And as soon as I got off that med, I was better. It was the med. And that is a side effect of that med. And so anyway, they took him cold turkey off of it, which is just brutal. And so he did what naturally anybody else would do. He would seek relief for that withdrawal. And so he started buying them on the street. And at the time he was buying them, it would be $10 a milligram. And he had a $200 a day habit, which then led him to steal from my family and my friends and extended family and our own brother, because he had this habit to support. And once that got and that also meant like going to university bookstores and stealing books to then go and sell on eBay, or taking, the last time he was picked up, it was for taking high-end jeans from a Dillard's because he was going to trade that. Because now by this time he had gotten into heroin because it's cheaper. And I can't even imagine the level of shame that he had around that. Like, I just, as big as my empathy is, I can't even imagine that kind of shame. And so my parents tried to get him into rehab. They one time took him to the only dual diagnostic center in the state that they live in and had a $12,000 cashier's check and said, just take him. However long this takes him, however long this holds him, take him, because we don't know what else to do any longer. Yeah. And he was in his late 20s at this point. And the place said, he doesn't have a needle in his arm, because my brother would go clean, cold turkey, for weeks or months at a time, just by sheer willpower. But of course, that only goes so far. And so they said, he doesn't have a needle in his arm. He's 2 weeks clean. We can't take him.
Okay. I'm just going to stop you for 1 second and
sure.
Explain for the audience what a dual diagnosis rehab is.
Yeah. So the dual diagnostic centers, the dual diagnostic rehabs, are centers that are able to not only combat the actual addiction, but the mental health behind the addiction. And there was only one in the whole state. So my brother was arrested in stealing these things, right? And he, even though he was in drug court and drug court was trying to place him in these rehabs, he would get to the rehab and be there 24, 48 hours. And then the rehab would understand the depths of the level of his mental health and go, we can't help you. which just blows my mind because I don't know any addict that doesn't have a mental health issue behind it. I don't understand that. And so they would send him back to the jail because they didn't know what else to do with him. And I don't know if you've ever been in a jail. It is not pleasant. It is not a pleasant place. And for somebody that is dealing with high anxiety, ADHD, and bipolar, that's probably the worst place that you could put them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And jails in America are privately run. Am I correct?
Some of them. Some of them.
Oh, okay.
This was the county jail. So he wasn't in a prison.
Oh, okay.
But he was in the county jail. Okay. Waiting for these charges to come through and to be whatever, be like to see the end of the case. But he had multiple cases because he had been caught multiple times, credit card fraud, like all kinds of stuff. And listen, I am not condoning what my brother did at all, but I understand it. Get it.
Yeah. And quite frankly, the beast that is addiction is all encompassing. It is all powerful. And it is absolute hell to try and get away.
Yeah.
The fact that he tried over and over, you got to commend him for that.
I don't know how he did it.
And
I honestly don't know how he did
it. Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. And wow, Nathan had to have been very strong to try as hard as he did.
He really did. He really did. But in the end, he just wasn't medicated properly. It just wasn't enough, let alone the hit that your self-esteem takes when you're supposed to be working and being a productive citizen. And he was brilliant on top of it, so that didn't help. He would sometimes try to outthink his illness, and that wouldn't do any good for him because he was like, oh, I'm smarter than this. And I'm like, yes. However, that's not how this works. You can't outthink the way that your brain chemicals are working. That's just how it's wired. You can't. Now, you can long-term rewire it, but that is not the short-term solution that you're looking for. And that takes intense therapy for a long time. And with the manic depressive, that is hard to sustain anything long-term, anything. Yeah, the longest he was clean by sheer will was 10 months. And that was the last time I actually saw him because I had leg surgery in August of 2015. And my mom couldn't get here. She had another family obligation. And so I said, hey, can you check with your probation officer or your parole officer? Yeah, your probation officer and see if you can come for a couple of weeks to help me out, play uncle, chauffeur the kids to their karate appointments, drive me to my appointments because I couldn't drive. And it'd be a nice getaway, get out of that state and be with family. And so he made the plea and they allowed him. And so he was with us for 3 weeks and played uncle beautifully. He battled I watched him battle his mental illness. I watched him because he wouldn't get out of bed some days unless I was like, bro, I need you up. He just couldn't, or he'd get up and he'd lay on the couch and the kids would be like, Uncle Nathan, because they were little at this time. Let's see, my oldest was 10 and the youngest was 8. And so they were like, Uncle Nathan, you want to go play ball or what, swim in the pool or whatever? And he'd be like, I'm sorry, guys, I just don't have the energy. And it was rough to watch. And I got upset with him. I did, because I was like, bro, what the hell? Just, oh my gosh. Yeah. I can't even imagine how he actually felt internally. And so, yeah, he was with us for 3 weeks. And that's the last time I saw him. That's the last time I hugged him. And he was gone 7 months later.
It's just heartbreaking that we think we've made such strides in medicine. And yet, into me, what is the most important segment is not adequately served. And it's not
at all
America, it's the world.
Oh, for sure.
We are still wrapped up in the silence, the stigma, and the shame because as much as medicine has made leaps and bounds in certain small areas. In fact, medicine has not kept up with technology and a number of other sectors that have made not just incremental experiments and leaps forward and finding changes for things that shouldn't be, but medicine is still at a place where they don't know why the pharmaceuticals work or do not. They still don't know most of the effects, that the ill effects that come from the pharmaceuticals. And often it's a hope and a prayer. And you said that yourself in how many times they had to change his medication to see what worked.
His ADHD medication, too. It was for both. He was a guinea pig. For years, he was a guinea pig with, hey, is this drug going to work? Or does that drug work? And I don't know if anybody's been on those kind of drugs. I'm ADHD, too. And I know at some point I'm over-medicated because I feel like a zombie. And I feel like parts are muted of me. Mm-hmm. And so if you can imagine that person who's used to experiencing mania, that's got to be a harder fall from there, or a harder, I'm used to being able to go and now I feel like a zombie. Of course they're going to say no. Of course they're going to go, no, don't feel good on this.
The dopamine and the other hormones and chemicals that the soup that we get and they get from being manic is just not happening. And yourself, pushing things for those of us who procrastinate, for those of us that have issues that way, when you do things at the last moment, you do get that dopamine hit. And so just imagine for someone that struggles with really big issues and they're losing that as well. So that's a constant battle.
Yeah, because in some ways that the mania served him.
Yes.
Of course. Who wouldn't want to stay up for 48 hours and get a bunch of shit done? Absolutely. Yeah. I totally would do that. Yeah. But yeah, so it was hard for him to give up, I imagine. I understand. So yeah, he was clean for 10 months and we don't know what happened. We don't know what triggered the relapse this time. But he relapsed somewhere into February, March of 2016. And then first week of March, he got picked up for stealing jeans, high-end jeans from a Dillard's. And he was put back into the county jail. And we were conversing. We were talking every other day. He was calling my mom, whatever. And the last day I spoke to him, he said, what time are you getting off work tomorrow? And I said, I'll be there somewhere around 4. I'll be home around 4 because I was working brunch because I was managing a restaurant here. And he said, okay, I'll call you around 4:30. And I was like, that sounds fantastic. I love you. And he said, I love you too. And he said, bye. And I got a call at 5 a.m. the next morning that he was gone. And actually, he wasn't gone. He was found in his cell hanging. And they had resuscitated him numerous times. And he was on life support at the hospital, all because there was a very tiny activity at the base of his brainstem. Just not even enough to make his heart beat and for him to breathe. But there was some activity. And by Oklahoma standards, because he was 32, and again, considered able-bodied, because there was this activity left, they had to put him, they cooled his body down and iced him down for 3 days. And then they slowly brought his body temperature back up. So he was found on the 13th. And on the 16th, he was defrosted, basically, and to see if they could get more activity moving on his brain. And it wasn't. And so my parents had to make the decision to turn the machines off. And I will never forgive. I can't. I've tried. But for them to force my parents to make that decision,
I'm so sorry.
And I think one of the worst parts for me is my oldest was born without an immune system. And so it took a lot of medical intervention on a constant basis. And I was in another battle with the insurance company to get this life-saving medication for my son. And so I had to be, I live in Las Vegas, so I'm 1,300 miles away from home. And I had to be here for an appointment. And because of that, I didn't make it home to be with my family. I actually watched the machines get turned off and watched for 30 minutes while he passed over FaceTime.
I'm so sorry.
So I didn't get to hug him again.
Yeah.
I didn't get to do all of that.
I know Nathan would understand because his nephew was important to him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely, he would have. I mean, he, when we found out everything going on with my son, Nathan got a tattoo of my son because he saw such strength in this child going through this massive, I almost lost him twice.
Yeah.
And so he saw such strength and he was so honored to be his uncle that he actually got a tattoo in my son's honor.
Wow.
So I know, but it also still sucks.
Of course, you know? Of course it does.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned to you before, we were in the same position with my sister and had to make that choice as a very small family. It's the only family that was really important were thousands and thousands of miles away. And there was no way that they were going to wait or put her through anymore because that is not what she would have wanted.
Yeah, so I landed 12 hours later.
Yeah, it's a horrible situation to be in, and there's no winners at all.
Not at all.
No,
not at all.
That is really. Really heartbreaking.
Yeah. And I think, so my parents started digging into his last few days at the jail. Why was he allowed to be alone long enough to commit this? What happened? And what we found was a folly of errors. The guard didn't round when he said he rounded. He falsified records. He admitted that. So there's a possibility he could have found my brother in process.
Yeah.
They refused to give my brother his lithium because his prescription had expired. However, he also had an abscess on his arm from shooting up.
Yeah.
So they gave him codeine for that, which is a scheduled drug.
I was just going to say, in America, that is a scheduled drug. Yeah.
So somebody had to prescribe that to him, but they wouldn't prescribe his lithium. They wouldn't give him his lithium.
Okay.
That
doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. And they weren't giving him the codeine on any kind of schedule. So that was like throwing him in and out of withdrawal.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
He was very honest on his intake sheets, like 185 questions. And I've seen it. I've gone through it. I've pored over it. He was extremely honest. Last time he used, the abscess, how much he used, like all of these things, what he struggles with. And they had all of the information they needed at their fingertips.
Yeah.
The day that he died, he had called the mental health. So there's a mental health contractor with that jail. So it's not part of the state, but it is a contract with the state to provide mental health services. And he called that number four different times that day and told him he was hallucinating and his anxiety was making him climb the walls. And there's no record of him getting help that day. And so my parents sued.
I can't say I blame them. That is an absolute waterfall of mistake on mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they hired a lawyer, they sued, and the state, in the middle of the lawsuit, the state legislation met and retroacted a law that protected all contractors for the last 3 years. Yeah. And so there was a huge cap on what my parents could get. So my brother at 32, my beautiful baby brother, who was such a light and was so tortured, was worth $150,000. That's it. That's it. That's what his life was worth. That's what our pain is worth. Wow. To that state. And I don't understand.
I totally understand why you don't, because that does not make any sense to me.
And they did it to cover their own asses. That's the gross part about that.
That does make sense to me, sadly. We've seen it here in the medical community.
Yeah. So my brother at 32 was worth 150K. My parents didn't even take the money. They gave it back to the state and said, do something with this. Train your staff.
My God.
And so a couple months later, there was this news splash about how they have mental health pods. And how long before you use those for overcrowding?
Yeah.
Versus actually what they're there for.
How are your parents doing today?
Oh, that's touchy. Thankfully, I was in therapy. I'd already been therapy almost 2 years at that time. And so that saved my life. My parents have not gotten any kind of help to this day.
Oh.
No grief support group, no grief therapy, no grief coach, nothing.
That's hard.
And I don't understand why.
Well, let me shed just a little light, because I'm a boomer. And we were told, it was drilled into us. You don't air your dirty laundry. You do not. You suck it up. Okay, I'm sure your father is a man. You, like me, were an Air Force brat. Okay. And in the military, you really don't put your family stuff out there. It can affect your job. Now,
yes, that's very
true. Not as bad now. When I was 12 to 14, I tended to push the boundaries of pretty much everything.
Of course, you're a teenager.
My mother liked to yell at me. But the big threat was always, wait till your father comes home. And my father, who never laid a hand on anybody intentionally, he would throw his glasses because I would frustrate him so much. And I can always remember, to this day, I can remember my mother saying, and how is he going to explain that? He's going to lose his job because he's got to go in and get another pair of glasses. Now, it doesn't make as much sense to me today at this age, because, maybe he was clumsy. They were often quite smashed. But that was the military way.
Very much.
You kept things quiet. If most families have the old alcoholic uncle somewhere, you had to keep that person in the closet. You didn't let them parade around the base or do something that was overtly out in public, because it just wasn't done. And that comes down to counseling and outside help, because that goes on their permanent record.
Yeah.
He
was retired at the time. And I absolutely felt that anxiety growing up, because it was very much your behavior affects your father's advancement.
Oh, yeah.
And so, whoa, that's a lot on a teenager that's trying to find their way in the world and experiment and make mistakes, and it wasn't allowed. Mm-hmm. And my father was very much pull yourself up by your bootstraps type. He's softening in his older years, but not a lot. And I think I would understand. The thing that sticks with me is that when I was 14, so Nathan was 7, we all went to family therapy to deal with Nathan. And so it's,
yeah,
okay, like I get it. But also, did we forget in the early 90s, we went to family therapy to deal with this? Like, why wouldn't you do that now in 2016?
Because he was a child. That's different. Maybe. That is different. Dealing with childhood problems. For some weird reason, my friend who lived four doors down from us on the base, her brother was a bit challenged, and he was preternaturally strong. He picked up his father when he was 9 years old over his head and threw him down the front of the house outside. He was like insanely strong, and I can remember them having to get some kind of help because he was quite the handful. And Janet, we knew because we lived right there, so we saw an awful lot of what went on with Robbie. Sure. But it was, it wasn't something you talked about. But again, he was a kid. I think that made a bit of a difference. The funny thing is, to this day, my dad's retired as my father has dementia. He's 91 years old, but there are certain things that my father can still do because he was military for so long. It's an automatic response, and it's good. He still, he gets up and he showers, shaves, does all his stuff. And I understand that's not always the case in dementia, but it's that military background that gives people a certain way of being. And that's really what I think, because we tried early on to have him maybe talk to somebody. But that was an absolute no-go.
Yeah. Like,
I don't need anyone to talk to. What are you talking about? Yeah. So it's, So there are certain things that are generational. And
for sure,
we're trying to open them up now because they didn't work. We can now openly say, what? How did that work for you? It didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's the trouble that I have, is my parents have that insight. Like, they know that their silent generation parents, that wasn't the way to parent. They've always tried to parent differently than their parents. I was always well aware of that. And so there's a disconnect of like, oh, so it only goes this far?
Yeah.
But there's all this too. Yeah. And it's, oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, oh no. We're only going to
do this differently. But not
so it's strange to me. And because of that, our relationship changed. And it's both great and sad because it did need to change.
Yeah.
But I wish it could have changed in a different way than it did.
Yeah.
And so I was estranged from them for about 18 months to 2 years because of being so deep in my trauma and then them being so deep in their trauma that it was just, my mother especially lashed out.
Yeah.
My father retreated, my mother lashed out.
Yeah.
And how do you manage that when you're in the depths of your own grief, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was really tough. And so we're
not only that, you are their child.
I'm the oldest.
You were never meant. Too. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, here, same here. But you were never meant to smooth the road for everybody. Our parents are the ones that technically are meant to do that. It's often not what happens. Okay. And I think this is another thing we have to get beyond as well. Because as things change, we have to learn to adapt to what is now in front of us. But it can be daunting when those generations before us, oh my God, so much was taboo. So much.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there are things that they do still. And I'm not trying to shame them. Everybody grieves in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things that they do still that kind of keep them stuck. And I don't understand. And I want to have empathy and I want to hold space for them. But I also see it like my mom for years had an alarm set on the 16th at the time of his death for at the same month, saying on the 16th of every freaking month.
Oh my God.
And it was like, but why? Because I promise you, you're not going to forget that. I haven't forgotten it. I don't have any alarms. I've never needed an alarm. My body actually knows that it's that week before I remember now. Because my body starts slowing down and it really does. It really does. And so it's like, why do you need that?
That's a form of penance.
That is a level of guilt.
Yep.
That is not helpful.
No.
At all. And I've watched her age so much in the last few years with that. It's staggering.
It's true. It's true. But yeah, I do. I see that as penance for not being able to change it.
Yeah, the last phone call they had ended not so nicely. And so that's the guilt that she's hung on to is the last thing she said to him was, I don't have time for your drama right now. And I can't even imagine. I feel guilty enough that I've got this BA in psych and I've done crisis counseling. I'm a life coach now. And so I felt badly enough that I didn't catch the signs, that he didn't say anything to me. Why didn't he call me? Like, I have all those questions that I will never have answered. And that I struggled with those for many years. And so I get it. I can't imagine that level and having that be the last conversation, because my last conversation, I have questions around and it ended fine.
Yeah.
So I'm sure she has a lot of feelings around that being the last thing.
Oh my God. Yeah. And he was her child.
Yeah. He was the baby of the family.
Oh my God. That's a whole other. Yeah.
Yeah. He was the baby and the most difficult. Yeah. Shocker, I know, if anybody has three children, you understand that baby ain't easy.
Yes.
All of the energy that they've had to pour into him, where does that go after?
Not only that, there's the guilt about you and your other sibling and the time that was taken from you that they now can't give back. And what it was it all for? When we just, in the end, we lose. There's so many sides to that. It just breaks my heart for all of you. And
yeah, me too.
It can be so hard to watch other people who are not grieving the way you are, who are not responding the way you are to things you expect. And Andrea, my friend, died when I was 16. I am 68. It was a very long time ago. But two of us had a conversation 3 days ago about one little thing that one of our friends had questioned at the time. And here we are, I'm all 6 years later going, oh my God. What the hell did that mean? We're going to do nothing good for ourselves other than drive ourselves a little crazy.
I think that's the thing that I do have a deep empathy for my parents. But it's, oh my, please stop. I love you. Please stop. Because this isn't helping you. And therefore, it is not helping anybody.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can't tell another person how to grieve.
You keep throwing life preservers and there's a ton of them around their boat, but they're just not touching any of them. And it's as hard as that is, it has to be okay, because when push comes to shove, the only one you're responsible for is you.
Yeah. And that's tough. And being the oldest daughter, the only girl, I was parentified for my younger brothers, yep. and grew up in a codependent household, a people-pleasing household. And so that's my natural tendency, is to want to rescue those around me, yep. even at the cost of my own mental health.
Yeah.
And so it's, come on, people, I'm trying yep. to help you here. Like, I have education, I have knowledge, come on. And it's difficult when you are throwing those life preservers and they're yeah. floating all around.
Just a sea of preservers. Yeah.
And they're still drowning.
Yeah. And to me, it's only recently that anything really useful has come to me, because there were so many years of just total loss. That effort into your boys and do the best for them based on what you don't want to do. And take that as a lesson you can embody to help your kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Sorry. Because when push comes to shove, our kids are who we need to focus on, because our parents can be very stuck in where they are for a multitude of reasons.
Yeah. And it's hard because I don't want them to spend whatever time they have left in this regret and guilt yeah. and shame. And because it ages you faster, it makes you sicker. It just, there's nothing good that comes of this. And I want them to be around for absolutely as long as possible. And while they continue to drown in this, I think they're just shortening their time with us.
Yeah.
And that, I think that makes me sad.
Yeah. And I think you just have to live with what they offer as best you can.
Yeah.
And just do the best you can for you and the boys and going forward. And who knows, someday they may pick up one of those preservers. They may acknowledge one. They might not even pick it up, but they might acknowledge one. And yeah. that's got to be okay.
Yeah. I think that's the next hurdle. You know what I mean? There's so many hurdles yeah. in grief, especially the survivors that remain after suicide. My brother, I think he thought he was saving us from his continued yeah. spiral. Mm-hmm. I don't think he understood that he was blowing a shotgun into our family. That those things don't heal. I lost parts of myself that I will never get back. They have changed forever. I lost 2 years to yeah. the grief. I don't even remember the rest of 2016 and all of 2017 and some of 2018. Like, I can look at pictures and go, oh yeah, we did that. But it's nothing I can recall at all. Yeah. It's just dark. It is a black hole then.
Yeah.
It is a black hole. And I don't think he realized that's what he was doing.
And I will say, never in my wildest dreams would I ever have believed I would have gotten to a place where I am now doing this and calling Andrea's death the best worst gift I was ever given.
That's true.
Because without it, I had suicidal ideation since I was little, and her going, I now understand it was that watershed moment for me, and I chose to dive into oblivion. I spent 4 years, God knows where, doing God knows what. You were guaranteed to find me in the evening at the cemetery for those 4 years.
Yeah.
If you can't find me, that's where people would go, because they knew that's exactly where I'd be. Not necessarily able to speak or be sober enough or not high and able to manage, but that was all I knew how to cope. And it's taken all the years later to understand all those feelings that we live with, all the pain and the guilt and the wondering and all those questions, for me, it's what keeps me here.
Yeah.
Through some really dark times.
I would never want to do this to anybody else. And that's what kept me here is, okay, I could check out. I think I'd be okay with it. But then what does that leave for the people behind? And I am not willing to blow holes in my children's lives. I'm just not.
Because we now know that removing yourself from the situation doesn't make it better for everybody around you. It makes it worse. It always makes it worse. And that's why they say suicide is a very permanent solution to what amounts to a temporary problem.
Yeah.
If we can offer today, if we can offer hope to the audience, because you are a beautiful, vibrant lady with two gorgeous boys, and you are living your life and you are doing good, and there's just so many things that are wonderful. Let's give the audience an idea of what that hope looks like for you.
So Nathan's death was the second best worst thing that first worst thing, second best thing that happened. Yeah. Getting my son stabilized and allowing him to live a pretty normal life is the first best thing, of course, because I spent just years and years of anxiety and energy. And oh my gosh, we were just talking about that yesterday. And I was like, all those years that I fretted and I was neurotic, and look at you now.
Gosh.
My gosh, I feel sorry for that version of me that just couldn't trust that things would be okay. And so with Nathan's death, once I started to pull out of the funk and the hole that I had just climbed into and pulled the dirt over myself, I'd always wanted to be an LMFT. I'd always wanted to be a therapist. And when I had my oldest, things changed because he became the priority, especially with his immune deficiency. So I had to let go of those dreams I didn't know when I was going to get back. And so with Nathan's death, with Nathan, he wanted to become a psychologist because I got my BA in psychology and he found it fascinating. And with his own mental health struggles, like he wanted to, but again, because of his bipolar, he was never able to sustain enrollment. Yeah. Because he'd get a depressive episode and that would be it. And I thought, okay, my son's stable-ish, relatively. What do I want to do with this? And so I went, okay, I'm going to help people. This is what I'm meant for. I know it's what I'm meant for. I don't know what it looks like. Here we go. And so I ended up in 2020 enrolling in to two coaching programs, and I got my health and life certificate. And then 6 months later, I got a Clarity certificate, spent 2020 in coaching programs, learning and rehoning my skills that I had let lapse for a long time. And so now I help women struggling with exhaustion, loss of identity, and indecisiveness due to putting everybody else ahead of their own needs. And so they feel lost and overwhelmed and frustrated and resentful and anxious and probably pissed off, because I was very much that woman for a million years that I will never get back. And so I know my brother is so proud of me, and I wouldn't be here without him. I know that. Would I give it all back for a hug in 3 seconds just to say, I love you? Yes, absolutely. I would. Absolutely. But that's not reality. And so the best thing that I can do is help others in his memory and talk about him, because he was so much more than his mental illness. He was so much more than his addiction. He was so much more than all of that. But that's how people remember him, is that he was an addict and he was mentally ill and he died by suicide. That's not enough. It's not enough.
He was Nathan. He was your brother. He was your kid's uncle.
Yep.
He was precocious, and brilliant, and your baby brother. And that's how you can remember him.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I've got two urns with parts of his ashes. My mom has the bigger one. And so sometimes I'll talk to him. I had a friend, and one of Bryce's nurse was over here one day doing his infusion. My son gets an infusion every 4 weeks to keep him stable. And she put her drink down in it and knocked over one of Nathan's urns. And she was mortified. She was like, "Oh my God, Stacey, I am so sorry. I am so sorry." And I just laughed and I went, "Don't worry, he didn't feel it." And I just laughed my tail off because my brother, if he had heard that, he would have been like, "Oh, good one." Because his sense of humor was very dark. And I just I laughed until I cried. Because I was like, "Oh man, that was so good." But yeah, I loved it. That stuck with me. Now it's been like, I don't know, almost 2 years since that happened. And I just laugh every time I retell that story because that's exactly, my brother would have been really proud of me for pulling that one out. And then I have his favorite shirt. This does not leave my side when I am at home. This has been something that it's now my security blanket. I sleep with it every night and it's been with me. It'll be 8 years next month.
Wow. Well, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you sharing Nathan's story with us. And I got to see firsthand, even before we started this conversation, what a genuinely caring and empathetic person you are. And I don't think this is the last time we'll talk.
Oh, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
I'm sure. Thank you so much for having this platform and allowing me to share him, because all that remains are newspaper articles about his death or his mug shots.
Yeah.
And that's not a fair representation of who he was.
No, it isn't. It isn't. So we'll remember Nathan fondly along with you. I thank our audience for listening. You can find all the information you need about Stacey below this, and it'll be along with the show notes. And I am definitely going to invite you to come back and join us again. Thank you so much, Stacey. I so appreciate this. I'm Elaine Lindsay. This is Suicide Zen Forgiveness. And as I always say, make the very most of your today, every day. And we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Thank you for being here for another inspiring episode of Suicide Zen Forgiveness. We appreciate you tuning in. Please subscribe and download on your favorite service and check out SZF's YouTube channel or Facebook community. If you have the chance to leave a 5-star rating or review, it'd be greatly appreciated. Please refer this to a friend you know who may benefit from the hope and inspiration from our guests. Suicide Zen Forgiveness was brought to you by the following sponsors. Truul Social Media, the digital integration specialists. Let them get you rocking page one in the search results. Canada's keynote humorist Judy Kroon, motivational speaker, comedian, author, and stand-up coach at Second City. Judy has been involved for over a decade in the City Street Outreach Program in Toronto. Lisa Sugarman, Boston-based author, columnist, and crisis counselor with the Trevor Project, America's largest suicide and crisis support network for at-risk LGBTQ+ youth, storyteller with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, survivor of suicide loss, and mental health advocate. Lisa's purpose aligns with Elaine's as Lisa shares content and sparks conversations to help end the stigma of suicide and connect people with the support and hope they deserve. Do you have a story to share? Do you know someone you think would be a great guest? Please go to szf42.com. And for our American listeners, that's szf42.com. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again.